Let me tell you about the new sports app we've launched as a part of our USA Today family. USA Today Sports Plus is the new sports app that puts the fans first. Get the latest scores, stats, and standings and enjoy interactive experiences with our award-winning sports writers. Download the USA Today Sports Plus app from the Apple or Google Play stores today. USA Today Sports Plus. Fan harder.
Hello and welcome to the Colts Cover 2 podcast. We are getting into the back half of May. I'm joined as always by Nate Atkins. And this time of year, the NFL tries so hard to make sure that there is no, there are no dead spots, dull spots on the calendar. But we're slipping into it a little bit. The schedule release was last week. Who you are kind of depends on like who you are and how you follow the team and travel. Probably if you travel to watch games or if you're in another city, you probably care about the schedule a little bit more than some other people. But yeah, we don't have as much news as we've had. We had Philip Lindsay signing, which we can get into a little bit. I think maybe it was a tad overanalyzed in certain corners of the internet.
Every single thing with Nyheim Hines is overanalyzed. We're probably at fault for some of that,
but yeah. So, we're just going to kind of take a grocery store approach here, where you're just running in and grabbing in from whatever aisles you can find. So let's start with Philip Lindsay. Two-time 1,000-yard rusher, fell on hard times in Denver. Let go, played with both Houston and Miami last year, which I don't know is a good indication of where any running back in the world is, because Houston was 32nd last year in yards per rush as a team. Miami was 31st. clearly not the same rushing attack he'd be a part of here in Indianapolis. But I don't necessarily think, and I think you probably agree with me, I don't necessarily think that Philip Lindsay's signing is some big indicator of what they're going to do with Nyheim Hines. I think what they were going to do with Nyheim Hines is more dependent on the quarterback change than anything. That when they have a quarterback who can throw the ball and they feel like are comfortable throwing the ball, Nyheim plays more and he plays in a lot of different spots. When they don't, he plays less because they have to emphasize the running packages. That's kind of the way it's been in 4 years, and I really don't think Philip Lindsay changes that.
Now, all I see with the Philip Lindsay signing is it's bracing for a world we haven't seen yet, but always could in the NFL, which is Jonathan Taylor getting hurt. Like, if this team wants to maintain, you know, its approach as a downhill run team that does a lot of play action, just the kind of way you want to live life with Matt Ryan, you need something else there. And like the whole way they want to use Nyheim Hines is not as a guy who's going to carry the ball 20 plus times a game. He's not effective doing that. And it would take him out of what they really want to do, which is kind of throw to him out of the backfield, motion him from the backfield to the slot or out wide back into the backfield. But yeah, it was spun in a very weird way where people thought that signaled Nyheim Hines moving to slot receiver. And I'm just telling you, they're not moving a running back in his fifth season to a position he's never played and is not going to be that good at. And I'm not saying Nyheim Hines isn't going to make good plays in the slot, because he will, but it's all going to come with motioning from backfield out or out to the backfield, lined up on linebackers. He's not going to become Cooper Kupp running against nickel corners. That just isn't how it goes in the NFL, and I don't think he'd be effective at it. And also, he can run the ball pretty well, too. They just don't want him to do it, you know, 20-plus times a game, which if Taylor ever got hurt would be the situation. So Lindsay, to me, is just a guy to have there, kind of get out in front of it in case just something bad happened with Jonathan Taylor or training camp injury or something like that.
Yeah, I think he actually has to compete for his spot. I don't think it's as assured as people are talking about. I mean, because he's rushed for 1,000 yards twice in the NFL, I think he obviously has experience. He has a leg up. But they've got a back that they like who can play special teams in Deion Jackson. They've got Devontae Price and C.J. Verdell are going to be in camp, undrafted free agents that they had to pay some signing bonus money for, some guaranteed base salary for. I think he has to compete for that spot. We saw last year that the carries for a number three back who doesn't play special teams, or really for any any back whose name isn't Jonathan Taylor or Nyheim Hines can be hard to come by when Taylor's healthy. And so he's going to have to prove that he can play special teams. I think he gives you a nice security blanket. You feel like you've got an experienced runner on the roster in case something does happen to Taylor. But I don't think that that means his spot is 100% assured if Price or Riddell looks really, really good in camp.
That's the thing. A lot of it's just getting to the season and seeing who's healthy. So, you know, if they have an injury, then you would trust him with a bulk carry load more than some undrafted rookies. That's kind of why Marlon Mack stayed around forever and wasn't doing anything. Was just in the event that someone got hurt, okay, now you can sub him in and he can run a lot. But on game day, if Taylor and Hines are out there, you know, the only value of another back really is to do special teams. There's really no carries to even give them. Maybe a guy like Lindsey with his track record is able to steal a few, but that's only if he's active on game day. But, you know, it's interesting with like Lindsey, and this is just true for the running back position. It's crazy to look at his career and how different he's run based on the team he's on. You know, like in Denver, made a Pro Bowl, and, you know, he averaged 4.8 yards a carry in 2 1,000-yard seasons. And then since then, I guess his third year in Denver, it was getting a little worse. But since, like last year, between two teams, 2.8 yards a carry. And like you mentioned, those were terrible run games. But it goes to show that, like, he's more of a, like, system-based runner. So he can run effectively when your run game is good on the whole. But it also, to me, leaves me to appreciate Jonathan Taylor, who I don't think is at all dependent upon that when you look at advanced numbers like the yards he creates on his own after contact. And we see it sometimes just ourselves like that. It is incredible that he had the success he did against the Raiders and the Jaguars those final two games when that offensive line couldn't block anybody. And it was like he was running for his life the second he got the ball in the backfield, got to the sidelines, and was able to turn like 7-yard runs out of stuff that should have been losses. So it is a reminder that like Phillip Lindsey, I think, helps if Taylor gets hurt, but there's probably no replacing Jonathan Taylor either way. It's just like keeping the drop off from being so dramatic that you have to become just a pass first team 70% of the time. But, you know, it can get carried away to, that's why I think people are getting carried away looking at what Lindsey did in Denver and assuming this just moves Nyheim Hines out. You don't even need him at this point. That's not the case here. They're both guys who could be effective running behind good offensive lines. It's just one guy, and Lindsey's built a little bit more for bulk if he has to do that, and Hines you want to use out of the backfield.
If they do use a back, whether it's Lindsey or somebody else, to keep some carries off of Jonathan Taylor in the right situation, I do think that that's a good idea. I think one of the things that we're going to be talking about with Jonathan Taylor over the next couple of years is how do you prolong his peak as long as possible at a very difficult position? And one of the ways to do that is to keep some carries off of him. So there were some games last year, I think, when they were winning and he was still being fed that I was like, maybe we could give this to somebody else right now.
They had said a little bit more about their quarterback too. So I think that's where the answer will come a lot, is just balancing out naturally and trusting your quarterback to create, you know, pseudo run game plays. Like that's what a lot of teams have done, is they find like an extension of the run game through the slot. The Colts basically ignored the slot last year. It didn't. They played 10 on 11 football last year, and the slot receiver was just there to stand.
Did the Colts ignore it, or did Carson Wentz ignore the slot?
It's true. It's true. The guy running the offense did not believe in the slot receiver. But that's where, like, it also depends on who's out there. Like, to me, this offense, when healthy, is totally built to keep carries off Jonathan Taylor, because you've got Hines in a much higher volume role. And guy we'll talk about a little bit here, Paris Campbell, that's something we haven't seen out there. But and now Alec Pierce on the outside, like there are more guys to get the football to than just Taylor and Pittman, which is what it felt like last year. Was every play was like, let's get the ball to these two guys and see what they can do.
I would like to see him. Well, even if some of the carries shifted to passes to Taylor, I'd be okay with that, because you know, he said last week when he was in, was it last week? Yeah, last week when he was in, he said that when he catches the ball in the open field, it's like being like a kid again. You get to play backyard football and you're not banging in there as much. It's just not the same sort of pounding that your body takes when you're running off tackle. So that's the Lindsey signing. There's not a lot else that they've done. They actually didn't sign anybody, any of the tryout players off of the minicamp. At least, not that I remember. There was no release about that, which is interesting. I mean, normally teams sort of cycle in like three or four. If you look around the rest of the NFL last week, there were a lot of tryout guys that they cycled in and out. But I think that it probably speaks to how much work the Colts did on this draft class and knowing who they wanted in the undrafted free agent. The only undrafted free agent who's been let go is Max Borgi, who was replaced by Philip Lindsay's presence on the roster. So I thought that was interesting. I mean, I guess they could still make a move, but normally those come almost immediately after the tryout. So
well, it's interesting. They've only signed two offensive free agents from the outside, right? It's been Philip Lindsay and Dennis Kelly.
Believe so.
Yeah. And those just came in the past couple of weeks. So it was like, I don't know. It's interesting. It's like I think they do believe in some of their guys more than other people do. And I don't know. It's interesting. Like, we talked about the T.Y. Hilton situation, and I think that's very tied to a few other things that we can get into with the roster. But like, the Dennis Kelly one's the one other one that, like, at this point they're doing so few that I tend to think there's a reason, specific reason for them other than just camp body. And so, like I said with Lindsay, I think it's bracing for a world where if Taylor gets hurt, you can still run the ball a lot. With Kelly, I kind of feel like that to me signals that they really want Bernard Raimann to be the left tackle so that it frees up Matt Pryor to be more of the versatile backup guard backup lineman who can do tackle but also guard, and or even potentially compete with Matt Pryor or with Danny Pinter at right guard, but probably more be that backup who moves interchangeably throughout all of them. And then you have a situation where if you lose two tackles for some reason, like they went through chaos last year, then you have two, you know, capable tackles. But I don't know what happens to Bernard Raimann if Matt Pryor wins the left tackle job and you have Dennis Kelly as the swing tackles. And then, you know, unless they're planning to move Raimann to right guard, I think when you draft a guy like Bernard Raimann, you're hoping for the best possible outcome, which is still left tackle, even if it's not right away week one. So it's just interesting when they bring in Kelly, even after they drafted Raimann.
Offensive line coach Chris Strasser said that because of Raymond's lack of long arms, which Braden Smith made a joke about his short arms yesterday that was amusing because he brought it up without any of us saying anything. But he did say that because Raymond's not like super lengthy and strider, like a big long strider, that he thinks that he could play inside. If not, I know that the Colts want him to play left tackle first. I think one of the other reasons to bring in Dennis Kelly is just they had four tackles play more than 200 snaps last year. And I think that's the second year in a row. I'm calling it up right now so I have the right stats. But I think that's the second year in a row that they've had more than three tackles play a bunch. Eric Fisher, Braden Smith, Julian Davenport, and Matt Pryor all played more than 280 snaps last year. In 2020, Anthony Costanzo, Braden Smith, Chaz Green played 200 snaps, and then there were some other snaps in there for tackles that they kind of cycled through some because they didn't have any. So I think part of it is just they signed Kelly because they've learned the lesson of the last 2 years, which is if you don't have good tackle options, you're going to be in big trouble. And the same thing applies for guard too. I mean, regardless of who's at left tackle, if you lose two linemen, then like say if you lose two linemen and one's a tackle and one's a guard, well, we know Matt Pryor can play guard, so Dennis Kelly then slides in at the tackle. You know, they're just trying to replace some of the depth that they lost, I think, with Chris Reed signing elsewhere, and they'll figure out how it all fits later. You know what I mean? But they needed a veteran, and Dennis Kelly gives them that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is just erring on the side of caution, and with especially the tackle spot with Matt Ryan, who just turned 37 this week. And, you know, it's one of those where, like, Matt Ryan, I think he can play with you know, just capable tackles. They don't have to be dominant. He's at that level of, you know, of cerebral advanced quarterback play where he can adjust to that. But I don't think he's going to adjust very well to just no tackle play because he's not mobile and he's 37. And also he's played really like the last half of his career with a lockdown, sturdy left tackle in Jake Matthews. So to go from that to something that's just, you know, a cratering weakness would be a problem. So it's just erring on the side of caution there. And my big thing why I think that it just makes sense to start Raymond at left tackle and see where it goes is the long-term payoff of hitting on that position in the third round of the draft is enormous. Like it's hard to do, but if you can do it, like I was just looking it up over the course of 4 years, Bernard Raymond's going to make $5.3 million total. So there's still a huge payoff to him becoming the left tackle, even over Matt Pryor, because Matt Pryor's on a one-year deal. And if he turns out to be a really good left tackle, you know, he earns another contract. Maybe even it's team friendly. It's still going to be way more than, you know, $1.5 million a season. Whereas like Raymond, you could get 3 years at just about the league veteran minimum, which is just a steal for what left tackles make these days. So I at least think they're going to give it as their best shot there until they get to the point where they realize, you know, maybe this guy just is naturally inside, or maybe he's just so not ready that to maximize this year with Matt Ryan, we're going to try Matt Pryor anyway. But even in that situation, I think it would still extend to where maybe Raymond's your left tackle by next year, but he just needs a little time to develop.
They are. He's starting at left tackle. Like he's going to start out his career at left tackle and then they'll go from there. Everyone from scouts to Chris Ballard to Chris Strasser has said they think he has the skills to be the left tackle. And so they're going to start him there and see what happens.
And in that world, that makes it where I don't think I'm not thinking of him even as a contender at right guard at this point until he actually makes that switch, because they really like Danny Pinter. And so to have never played right guard, to start out at left tackle in camp, and then whenever if he eventually makes that move, he's now trying to catch up on a guy who's got 2+ years of doing it. You know, everything to me still spells that they really believe in Danny Pinter as the right guard. The way that Braden Smith talks, it just feels like they're ready to move forward with that tandem there. And so Raymond to me kind of feels like a free player at this point. You know, like that was the free pick they sort of got moving up from the fourth to the third with the trade back for Alec Pierce. And they seem to be treating him that way. Like, we're going to do whatever's best for him. We don't need him, or we're at least building our line to a point where we don't have to play him right away if it just doesn't feel like we should do that.
I've got a long story on Raymond coming, and there's a couple of things that interest me about him that just it'll be interesting to watch how he develops, just because there's a couple of things. I talked to everybody from his coaches in Austria to his coaches in high school, to his coaches at Central Michigan, to the Colts. And there's a couple of through lines that go through the whole thing. This is a guy who's going to fit right in with the Colts' offensive line from a work ethic perspective. At every step of the way, from the time he was 14 until now, the coach has some story about having to kick him out of the gym or trying to get him or hit, like him trying to work out too much or trying – or just putting in so much effort. You know, he gained 45 pounds of muscle, essentially, when all the rest of us were sitting on our couch bemoaning the lack of a gym. I mean, I know he had some help from the strength and conditioning staff at Central Michigan, but that's really hard. It's really, really hard.
So he's the rare player where when coaches say he's the first in the gym and last to leave, they're actually not lying.
Yeah, every
there is only said that's that. One of my favorite things, because there's only one of those guys on the team, and coaches will list off like six guys who are the first in the building and the last to leave.
Everyone I talked to said, like, with him, it's almost like you have to be like, hey man, maybe after two, like his high school coach was like, we had to tell him like after 2 days and 5 hours of meetings and everything like that, like maybe we're not going to open up the gym for you yet. How about you go home and get something to eat and then come back? And then maybe we'll open the gym if we're still here. So he sounds like that. And then there was something that Braden Smith said that I think just fits the sensibilities of this offensive line a ton. He said he's a finisher. That's what matters to this offensive line, is how do you finish people off? How nasty are you, essentially? And they've already noticed, even with that, that like just watching his tape and everything, that he's a finisher. I think that fits this offensive line. And then the athleticism. Strasser was saying that the reason they don't care as much about short arms is that they care more about the feet. This is a guy who played wide receiver and tight end up until 2 years ago. Like, he's got the feet. His feet are incredible. He's got the athleticism to do that stuff. So there's a lot of reasons to be. I try not to get too into prospects because I don't know who I'm going to deal with once the draft picks are actually happen. But when you hear the Colts talk about him and you talk to other people around him, you're like, this guy sounds like a Colts offensive lineman. Whereas there were left tackle prospects in last year's draft who we found out after the fact did not sound like Colts offensive linemen in some of the stuff that you heard about them in some of those areas. Raymond sounds like a guy who's built to be part of this line.
It was also interesting when Braden Smith made that joke about the short arms, and we kind of asked him about, like, how do you feel about, you know, being pegged with short arms? Like, he did not say it doesn't matter, though. You know, he made it. I think what he said is that you can always make it an excuse if you need to, but your job's basically to play so it's not an excuse. But it probably is. There are times when he probably looks at other linemen who have an extra couple inches on their arms and wishes he had that. So, like, it is an advantage to be long limbed like that, but it's not necessarily like a, you know, it's not like a non-negotiable factor.
Strasser's point is that they look for guys who have the foot speed and quickness to make up for it. Essentially, he said they play with his term for it is they play with range. And he's essentially saying that they make themselves longer than they are because of the way they move with their feet is the way they look at it. So,
and I know the other part of it, at least the way that the scouts looked at it when we talked to them, is that, like, they love how Raymond, when he does get beat or maybe doesn't have the greatest play, just, like, improves within a game and bounces back. Because I think that becomes a big thing. If you have short arms and you start getting beat, like, you have to be so confident in your technique and in your feet that if you lose even a little bit of confidence and you can't make up for it with length, I mean, that's when you become potentially a liability. And so they feel like he's a guy that, you know, maybe he isn't the most perfectly, lengthy prospect, but he's good enough at his feet and he has confidence in the work ethic to continue to work through that. Like, you add all that stuff up, the short arms, the amazing feet, and the elite work ethic, you have what we've seen is, I think, the best left tackle of our lifetime, which is Joe Thomas. And it's always the guy that people, it's kind of an unfair comparison because people say, well, he played with short arms, so other people can do it. It's like, well, he had some of the quickest feet you'll ever see and probably the best technique you'll ever see. But it does show that, like, if you really work at it and are that confident in your feet and technique, that there is a path.
I don't know when that story is going to run exactly, but it's written, it's there for the editors. So really, really kind of a fun thing. Just a lot of different little details from his path. It's a hard path. Like, I think we hear he comes from Austria and we understand, like, it's more difficult than being in America, but he played in this club team in Vienna that has been around for decades, and him and a guy who joined the Cardinals through the International Player Pathway Program are the only two NFL players that club has ever produced. It's really hard.
Yeah. That was a trademark of a lot of guys in this class. I mean, like, you talk about Drew Ogletree played two positions, two schools, two seasons in a pandemic. You know, it's like how guys have had to work through things in the past is a good indicator of how they will deal with the natural struggles that will come as a pro. And that's where I think a lot of busts happen in the NFL is just like you can't predict what you've never seen before. And some guys who are incredible athletes and go to great programs and have great support systems just were never exposed on that level. And they get exposed at the NFL level. I feel like we got to make at least one reference a podcast, but I think the last quarterback the Colts had ran into that exact same thing. Once he got out of North reference. Dakota.
I already did it once.
Did you? Okay. Dang it. We already got our fill. I didn't need to double dip, but I would say, I think that's a lesson the Colts learned last year. Though, is that, like, don't, and I've heard that from a lot of teams, like, don't take, like, put a value on adversity and having worked through it. And sometimes it even means, like, guys who may not have the most risk-free profile in the path, which is Raymond, right? He hasn't played that long. You know, or Drew Ogletree hasn't played the highest level competition. Don't take it as a negative, because sometimes it's a positive if it shows how they've had to work through a lot of obstacles and carve out their own path, and they never had it made easy for them.
Yeah, that's one of the things the Colts try to figure out in the pre-draft process is, has a guy handled adversity? How did he handle adversity? How did he respond to it? That's one of those things that, like, you know, that we always talk about in the months leading up to the draft. There's a part of the draft that we can't really touch, and it's the interviews. You know, I mean, we get a little bit from the public, but they end up knowing more than we do. And that's one of the big things the Colts try to figure out is that, okay, has this guy been through adversity? When it hit, what happened? How did he handle it? And, you know, with Raymond, like one of the adverse things, and it's in this story, is that, you know, if you talk to the Central Michigan people, they'll say, you know, we asked him to move to left tackle and he was all in, all like right away. And that wasn't really true. That's how he responded outwardly, but inwardly, he was thinking, there goes my path to the NFL. I've been a tight end the whole time. He was actually in line to start. He had caught the previous tight end was moving on. And then he had caught 10 passes each of his first 2 years at Central Michigan. And then they asked him to move to left tackle. And he's thinking, okay, I'm off the path. And he did it anyway. And it turned out to be the right decision and the one that actually probably got him picked in the draft. But, you know, that's a tough thing when you've spent your whole life working toward this one thing and you think that it's being shifted and you have to help the team. I mean, he's got other adversity in his life. I think coming over from a different country and all that stuff is there. But from a football standpoint, that's a big deal. Like he's been through things not going the way he expected them to go.
Well, and that tight end background also does give one area where he can challenge Danny Pinter, which is as the
red zone target.
Yep. The eligible lineman in the red zone. Danny Pinter's competition now.
Unbalanced line, slip him into the flat. This man had 20 catches in college. Perfect red zone target.
It's true. That's
Everybody's looking up. Everybody's looking up at the trees going to the back of the end zone. Everyone's looking up to Woods and Allie Cox and Pittman going to the back of the end zone. You just slip 6 foot, yeah, 6 inch Bernard Ryman out and throw it to him.
What's another 6'6" guy? They've got like six of them running patterns anyway. Matt Ryan will find the mismatch.
Shifting gears a little bit here. Nate was at a wedding last week when the schedule came out. We'd already taped our podcast by then. I will admit to not putting a lot of stock in the schedule right away, because it tends to change. People get hurt. Teams end up being way better than you thought they were. It ends up looking different in the fall. But, you know, while you were at your wedding, also Nate was texting me about the schedule release while he was at his wedding, which I hope the people that he was in the wedding for didn't listen to this podcast. Because I'm telling them that he was worried about the schedule when he's just celebrating. What stuck out
first?
What stuck out for the from what you saw?
The way we look at it is more about travel. No one cares about that. But so like we already knew who the opponents were, and it was going to be on the easier side of the NFL for that reason. The thing that was really amazing to me is how almost all the division games are in the first half of the season.
Yeah, it's right away. It's five of them right away.
It's like, we expected them to, it's not normal or not abnormal for them to start week one that way, but like they're going to be at a point where they're going to play their second game against the Titans in week seven, second game against the Jaguars week six. Like there's not,
I think it's five games in the first seven. I think it's five of the first seven.
So these teams aren't going to change that much from the first meeting to the second meeting the way that we normally have seen. And so I don't know what that's going to play out to mean exactly. It's just kind of weird that it's like so much of that division will be decided right off the bat. And for the Colts, I think you're really eyeing a decent start to the year, because you got the Titans in week four and then the Titans again in week seven. Like, if they're climbing out of a hole and they're not playing at their best at that level, like those two games, it's pretty easy to see where this division is going to go. It's going to go either Titans or Colts. So they've got to start off in a hole this year would be especially detrimental, because not only could you potentially lose the Titans, but if you're not beating the Jaguars and Texans, then the Titans are. Like, that's where the division starts to become a real uphill battle. Whereas, like, I think they should be the favorites in that division, but if they start slow again, it's easy to see where they're just going to be behind and trying to climb uphill, especially in week three, they've got the Chiefs. So it's a weird schedule in that way, but.
Yeah, I think if you're the Colts, you're looking at this as, the way you have to look at this is, we have an opportunity to put our foot on the throats of the rest of the division right away. That's the way you have to look at it. You just have to, approach it that way. And try to get it to go that way. You know, that's, you get like, I know they've had the bad starts, but I would guess that the way Reich usually approaches things is to get them to focus on the positive more than wallowing in the, there's both of that. Like, you have to understand, like, you can't just focus on the positive and slide into another season slow, but he's not going to want to be going into these games scared, like, we can't give it up. So I would assume that he's probably going to be like, hey, we have a chance here with the division to put everybody else on the back burner and do what the Titans did last year. Essentially, the Titans were out in front of the division so far. The Colts were going to have a massively difficult time coming back. The Colts have a chance to do that this year just based on the way the schedule is.
Yeah. And the other weird thing to me is, like, you think last year, the weirdness of that season was they started so slow and then they ended so poorly. And then, like, the other games they were so good at. This year, like, they start and end the year theoretically with the easiest games on their schedule. You know, they've got Texans and Jaguars the first 2 weeks, and the final 2 weeks are Giants and Texans. And at least three of those games could be against teams just tanking for the number one pick. And of course, we know enough now that to know that at Jacksonville should not be considered just a walk in the park. On paper, it should be an easier game, but it's never been that way. But especially the end of the year, I think, is a nice finish for them, because, you know, to finish at the Giants and then against the Texans, who knows what those teams even are in January and what they're playing for and what their roster looks like. Like, those both franchises have given you indications so far that, like, they're the type of teams where, like, if someone is 60%, they might go on IR. Like, it's a race to the top of the draft. So it could work out really nicely, because it's going to be tough, again, to have a late bye week. Week 14, players hate that in a 17-game season. But if they can get to that bye week and be in the mix, at least in the division, you know, to end those final four games or the final two are against potential tanking teams could be nice.
Outside of that, obviously the Colts got primetime games at home. I have long said that the Colts disparity in primetime games over the last 5 to 7 years is insane. I don't want to hear any arguments about how Indianapolis is a small market. Games on TV, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't, like, no one has kept Green Bay off of primetime, off of getting Lambeau Field in primetime, because the market is small.
No, New it's Orleans, just about the size of
the New Orleans. The New Orleans market is also small, very small, and they get games at the Superdome all the time. Like, that makes it, so throw that one out the water. I don't necessarily, because of that, I don't think it matters very much for the TV viewing audience. But, like, up until they got this one, I think our editor Nat Newell's research was that they had gotten 30.6% of their primetime games at home, which was dead last in the league. That's insane. Like, it's good for, I think the Colts want a primetime game because there's buzz, there's juice, there's all that stuff. I know they hosted two last year. One was flexed and one was a Thursday night game against the Jets, which, calling that a primetime game is a little bit like calling what you get at Denny's a steak. It's basically the same thing. But there's juice around it. There's all this stuff. Like, Colts fans want to be able to be at home. Lucas Oil looks fantastic in primetime. Like, the lighting and everything looks great. There's a lot of reasons for them to want it. They finally gave them 2 Monday night games. They can't be flexed. If this was next year, they could. But they can't be flexed. They're going to have them. And the opponents are like, they're teams that people are going to watch. The Steelers, there's a chance that they're not very good by that point. But it's, they have one of the biggest fan bases in the league. And then you get the Chargers. Justin Herbert is going to bring viewers in no matter what.
That's what I think drives a lot of the primetime slots. It's not the size of the city. It's the size of the fan base. And the Packers have been, you know, kings of, well, they have their own passionate fan base locally, but they're also kings of all the bandwagon fans that I had to grow up with back when Cleveland didn't have a team. Everyone in the world wanted to be a Brett Favre fan. And then so like the Saints too is like, that's a whole regional team. So that's why they get draws.
The only thing is that still doesn't explain to me why when they're in primetime, the Colts don't get primetime games. Like, I understand putting teams in primetime more because they have a good team. But once you've put the team in primetime, like the Colts historically, or at least over the last decade or so, they just won't give them a home game.
Oh. Yeah, where the game is played doesn't matter at all.
It doesn't matter at all. Like, I totally understand that you want stars in primetime. Not arguing that. But, like, they used to do this when Andrew Luck was here, which makes no sense.
Yeah. I mean, they just base it on what they think is going to – pretty much they're like, who's going to stay up for this late game in the Eastern time zone? And they bank on the bigger fan bases to do that. So the Saints have like half the South who can tune in. Steelers fans are rabid like that. And I don't know. I guess they don't view the Colts the same way. But this will be a good test because they've got a few of them. And who knows? Maybe the ratings will be really, really good. I think this Colts team is going to be pretty good. And it's also going to have stars that will kind of make those games interesting. The way that Jonathan Taylor did last year against the Patriots. And now they have a quarterback who's going to complete more than five passes, I think, in a game like that. So maybe they'll keep getting them.
Taylor, I think, changes the equation considerably. I really do. Because, like, I remember when I was a kid, the Lions frequently played in prime time. And it had nothing to do with the Lions being any good. It had everything to do with Barry Sanders. And I think what Taylor did against the Patriots in prime time, to a lesser extent what he did against the Jets in prime time, Taylor's the kind of star that they're going to want to put in prime time. Now, like I just said, the question is, when they're in prime time, are they going, like, do they give them home games? Because the football, from a football standpoint, the big advantage is if you get a primetime game at home, you avoid the overnight flight that gets you back at 5 o'clock in the morning, which makes an already short week from a primetime game even shorter because you have to fly back so late. So that's the football reason to want to have primetime games. So it's okay. They have Taylor. They have people you want to see in primetime. Now, are the can they get home games instead of always being on the road, letting other cities getting the boost from the juice around a primetime game, and letting other cities and other teams get the benefit of playing at home on what ends up being a short week?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the irony, is Indy's considered this great convention and event city, but they don't get them for the NFL that much. That's outside of 1 p.m. It's also kind of weird. Another just random quirk is just how almost all the primetime games in the second half of the season, even the games that start at like 4:25 against the Commanders and 4:05 against the Raiders, like all those games. So what is it, like five of the final eight and then are in primetime or 4 p.m. or later. And then two of those games, Vikings and Texans, have not had game time set. I don't think they'll put Colts Texans in week 18 in primetime, but you never know.
Week 18 is always weird because they don't actually base it on, I mean, they're not going to end up, I can't imagine the Texans are going to end up putting him in a win and in situation that ends up on Sunday Night Football. But they could end up getting shifted to the late afternoon because of some, like, they always end up having to, like, juggle, like, whether or not five teams can affect each other in the playoff race. And then they all move somebody to 4:25. That was my big worry last year because I had an early flight back from Jacksonville. And I thought they were going to move it because of AFC playoff possibilities. Because it has nothing to do, it ends up having nothing to do with that game. It's all about, like, where, like, in this scenario, where the Colts are in relation to other seeds in the AFC and have it wanting them to play at the same time so they don't rest their starters because they can't get the two. That's what gets really weird about week 18.
And I remember we thought they were going to do that with the Jacksonville game. Then they didn't. And then that was the nicest thing the NFL has ever done to America, was to not make everyone watch the Colts against the Jaguars.
Right.
And if that had been a primetime game, they may have banned the Colts for the next like 5 years from having another one, because that game was worse than the Chuck Pagano fake punt.
This year, we don't have to worry about it as writers, because we don't have to worry about getting back. We're here. It's a home game. So if they move it to 425 with the rest of the AFC for some reason, who cares?
Well, that's why I'm guessing you are, as the person obsessed with holidays, very happy that December 26th is a home game.
After last year being an absolutely miserable holiday schedule for dad with young children, this one is much better. No Halloween game, no Christmas Day game at all. I think Thanksgiving is fine. We don't have anything to worry about on Thanksgiving.
They play Monday after Thanksgiving, so
yeah. See, so I get an extra day on the weekend. Nice. It's great, great for a dad. I mean, the people listening to this podcast could care less. Whether or not it affects me or not, but from a holiday standpoint, it worked out much better than last year when I was away on Halloween, away on Christmas, was home for Thanksgiving, but was getting over the flu I got from Buffalo. So, like I said, no one listening to this cares whether or not it bothers me. They just don't. They shouldn't.
No, I just had to make a. I was just trying to make a holiday reference since, you know, that's like become a thing on the podcast. You know, you got to scratch certain boxes off. Like, we got the Wentz reference.
That's true. We got a Wentz reference.
We need a draft day one, but we did an entire segment with Zach Hicks over draft day. So I figured,
this is a draft day lull. We're in a draft day lull. I mean, we've mentioned it here, but like the draft has already happened. So I've moved past Sonny Weaver Jr. for at least 4 months.
We'll see about that.
It'll come back. It'll come back in the regular season for sure. The only other thing we were going to talk about, we talked to a couple of the injured players who are coming off of injuries yesterday, Dio Odengbo and Paris Campbell. The Colts don't have a ton of guys coming off of injuries. You can remind me if I've got somebody wrong here. There's Odengbo, Blackman, Campbell, Tyquan Lewis, Darius Leonard's ankle, whatever's going on with that. Other than that, not a ton of big injury issues. Not like outside of Blackman, there's nothing like last year when Fisher and Odengbo were both coming off of Achilles and we knew that they might not start the regular season.
Yeah, I think Blackman may be the only one that's like that, who's even... maybe you would even say not healthy right now. I mean, I don't know. Darius Leonard has kind of been, he's been putting off ankle surgery. So I don't know. It's always possible that could flare up. But like we're talking to Dio and Paris yesterday, both sounded like they're full go now. And they're like,
which makes sense. Dio was playing at the end of last year. Campbell was back for the regular season finale. Like they've been full go for a while. Tyquan Lewis, that patellar tendon injury, I don't know where he is. Next time we get Reich, we got to make a point to ask where Blackman is, because he is coming off of the Achilles, but he has about a 3-month head start on where Fisher and Odengbo were last year. They got hurt in late January. He got hurt in October. So he's got a head start on it.
Fisher's the best benchmark for that, because that affected him, felt like, the whole season. But that's why I think they've braced for Blackman being out, is they signed Rodney McLeod to a 1-year deal. Nick Cross is more of a long-term play, but they did trade up and add him there. They signed Armani Watts as a guy.
We were joking about this yesterday in the we're taping this on Thursday, so Wednesday is the day we do our interviews. We were joking about this yesterday. Last year, they went into the season with essentially two safeties and George Odom, who's played good safety for them in a reserve role, but they didn't want to. And this year, their roster is just full. They're chock full of safeties. They've got safeties everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially after going to the rookie minicamp last week and seeing Rodney Thomas playing free safety. Like they 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 oh. they They've got all kinds of safeties.
And I think that's where Marcel Dabo said they think he's going to be.
He's more of
a practice squad guy right now.
He was at nickel. He was kind of playing nickel last week in rookie minicamp. Right. We'll see where he ends up, but that's where when they had their quote unquote first 11, take that with a huge grain of salt because it's rookie minicamp, so none of the actual first 11 are out there. Cross was the strong, Thomas was the free, and Dabo looked like he was playing nickel. He did some moonlighting at other spots, but he was mostly at nickel.
Yeah, they seem like, and they should be bracing for Blackman not to be ready in time, because I think two lessons they learned last year was, number one, they didn't have enough safety depth, and that can kill you in a passing league. And then number two is that I think they put too much on Eric Fisher coming back from an Achilles injury at an important position. So, you know, and they didn't really have any tackle depth, as we talked about. So it's just setting it up to where if Blackman needs to not be available at the start of the year, you've got Rodney McLeod, who started over 100 games in this league, to just slide right in there. And then, you know, Kari Willis or Nick Cross or a combination of those two at the other safety spot.
They're in a better spot to cover some of these guys coming back off of injury, because, you know, we don't know where Lewis is at with his patellar tendon recovery, but Odengbo is healthy. And Odengbo plays the same role, you know.
And the interesting thing to me yesterday is, like, when we were talking to Paris Campbell, and he said that, like, he is 100% right now. He got the screws taken out of his foot in the plate, and like, right after the season. And he's 100% right now. Every single thing is full go. Everything is healthy. And that is not the way any fan seems to discuss him. It's almost like he's in Julian Blackman's state, where they're like, well, hopefully he can come back from this horrific injury. Look, the dude's healthy. And that's no guarantee of staying healthy, but no player on the roster has that either. So the Paris Campbell conversation to me has been incredibly bizarre since I got here. And I understand where, like, fans are approaching it from their point of view only, which is they're Colts fans who drafted a guy who hasn't played in for 3 years. He's played 15 games in 3 years, and it's been a new thing each year. And I understand why you feel snake bitten by that. But, like, really, is in this game, any player can get hurt at any time. And, like, we right now we talk about, like, Jonathan Taylor being incredibly durable. If he, like, tears his ACL, he's going to miss games, guys. Like, he's not playing through that either. And then all of a sudden, all it takes in this game is two straight years of having some injuries. Rodney McLeod just ran into that too, where he's had two surgeries in the past 4 years after a long stretch of durable play. It comes and goes. So it's just been odd to me the way that, like, we talk about health and durability as, like, an actual ability. Like, the phrase, the best ability is availability. That's great for, like, building a team and, like, what you can count on and what you need to have out there, but that has nothing to do with actual football ability. And it's weird that it's been like this this sort of retrospective look at Paris Campbell and who he is based on the fact that he hasn't been out there, and that somehow changed the ability of this player who was a second round pick for them, who right now is healthy, and right now, for as long as he can stay healthy, is their starting slot receiver.
That's just the way this works here in Indy. When I covered the Saints, the fan base didn't hate injured players as much as they hate him here.
I'm conditioned in Detroit because those fans hate the franchise so much that, like, they would just blame the franchise for their management of injuries, or that they counted on that player. Like, it was always
there's that way, which is how I think it should be. There's some of that, and I think that's justified, but there is a I think there's a segment of Twitter that is vocal, and you end up seeing them say, it's a personal failing when someone gets hurt, which is, no one wants to have surgery. Like, there's not even really like an argument. Like, all of these guys want to be on the field. They want to be healthy. They want to be producing. None of them are like, you know, it'd be great to get cut on, and have some stuff stitched together, and then have to spend a year rehabbing it instead of working. That's insane. That's an insane thing to, like, insinuate or think or whatever. Like, so there's an element of luck in this. And with Campbell specifically, there was nothing in college. Like, he was never hurt in college. Like, Kamoko Ture was hurt in college. So you could see some of that. You could see some of the history of that, where you can go, okay, the Colts took an injury risk there and it bit him a little bit. That there was no injury history with Campbell. What's happened to him in the first 3 years of his career is something that I've never figured out how a team is supposed to identify how a healthy player is going, whether or not a healthy player is going to continue to stay healthy in the NFL or not. I think if teams knew how to do that, it would be the most closely guarded secret in the history of the NFL, because every team would want to know how to accurately predict whether or not someone's going to get hurt.
Yeah, I mean, there are some players who have higher risk factors than others based on their prior injury history or maybe their size. Like, we've seen those 5'8 running backs who struggle to stay healthy for any length of time. But, like, when there's not that in play, which there isn't with Paris, he's a 6-foot player who has played high volume roles. Again, he was a running back in high school, ran for 1,500 yards, played really in the middle of the field in the Big Ten, had 99 touches his final year. Like, if anything, he had the most durable profile coming out. So when there's not this, like, underlying risk factor that's different than another player, it's like, it's just dealing with probabilities. And it's like, if you got struck by lightning today, that doesn't make you more likely to be struck by lightning next year. You know, like, it doesn't have any carryover at all. It's the same percentage as it would be on any given day. Paris has unfortunately had some really bad luck with that. It's happened to come to him, and it's happened to come in the 3 years he's been in the NFL, when it didn't happen in 5 years in college and it didn't happen in 4 years in high school. And again, fans are not paying attention to that here, but that is absolutely part of the story. And if you're going to look at the risk factors, you have to look at that too. And like, there's no reason to look at him, his abilities and his build, and assume he's going to get injured other than to be cynical, which is where a lot of this goes. And it's like, fans feel like, yeah, that they were let down by a player. Look, it's unfortunate when they get injured, but like, that's all it is. But at the end of the day, like, to me, if we're going to like grade this on a scale of toughness, like, the toughest thing to me is to keep coming back from those and to do the rehab and to get back on the field and to try and trust your body again when it's let you down. Like, that is way tougher to me than just playing out there and having never gotten hurt. And I'll tell you, players around the league really respect it. And it's always just what's funny with sports fans. It's like, guys who played 14 years in the NFL will look at a guy like Paris Campbell and say, that guy's tough. But some person who sits on a couch and gets winded carrying groceries from the car says, that guy's soft. And it's just a silly conversation.
My biggest thing is that when a player has gone through injury the way Campbell has, the reaction as a fan should be disappointment for the player rather than anger at the player, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
that is a great disconnect.
I think that's the biggest deal. It's just, you know, there's like, you know, you do want guys to be, you have a guy like Philip Rivers who played through everything, never said a word about it. That's a kind of toughness that's really impressive to me. That's really impressive in the league. I know Rivers earned a lot of respect with the Colts for playing through what happened to his toe. You know, that's sort of the Favre thing. Like, Favre never missed a game, even though he was constantly, you know, wrecking thumbs or ankles or whatever, ribs. But there are some injuries that you cannot play through. And Paris Campbell has had injuries you cannot play through. You can't play through, as a wide receiver, you cannot play through a broken foot. You can't play when your ligaments in your knee aren't connected anymore. Like, there's some things like that. And that's not an issue of toughness. That's not an issue of playing through pain. That's just an issue of he got hurt. And like I said, I understand. And it's like, it does matter, because the team does end up, like, teams do end up making decisions based on whether or not a player has injury history. Like, if they don't feel like they can count on a player to stay through a season, they will let him go. That's true. But the way to look at that, I don't think, is this player has some sort of moral failing, which is the way it often comes across in 280 characters. It's this is really tough for this player. This is tough because they don't want to do this.
Well, and you talk about, like, if you want Paris Campbell to be out there as a fan, there's no one in the world who wants it more than he does. I mean, you're talking about a guy who has you know, young kid at home who's entering a contract year in a league where nothing's guaranteed. And what's interesting is this spring, you compare Paris Campbell to Christian Kirk, and they were both drafted in the second round, 1 year apart to play slot receiver. Both came from big schools, highly productive players, came into the league slot receivers. And Christian Kirk just signed a multi-year deal worth $18 million a year. Like, that is everything Paris wants. And that's why, like, this has been crushing to him, is to not be in that same spot yet. But, like, so no one wants it more than he does. And that was the thing that came out when we were talking to him, is how he's, you know, seen the tweets and he's heard the gripes and the pot shots. And it does get to a person, and it puts, you know, puts pressure, and it makes them feel, you know, it's what's tough about this game. And why, what I love about the Colts is they have enough players who are willing to speak about their mental health. In the franchise is very forward with it, with all their kicking the stigma initiatives. But, like, when you judge your self-worth on a game and you can't be out there for it, you naturally look at yourself as a failure. And so it's like, you know, this is way harder on them than it'll ever be on a fan who, you know, watches them one day a week and then that's it. But, like, the thing that's just crazy to me is, like, the guy that goes out there and gets hurt trying to make plays for your team should be applauded and not, like, criticized or not ripped. I will never understand that for as long as I cover this team, and I'll call it out every single time I see it. But it's like, these guys are trying to deliver for your team and got hurt in the process of it, and somehow that leads you to a joking, cynical, pot-shotting type of place, which is everything that's wrong with Twitter. And to me, like, if you do that, like, there are parts of fandom that are just naturally irrational. But if you take pot shots at players for getting hurt, trying to make plays for your team, you're just a terrible fan. And so I'm always going to remind those people that they're terrible fans.
Nate coming in hot here at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, I've had to mute enough people recently. So, you know, we'll get it off here. And so what I like is when they make those jokes is that I can just mute them and never see them again. But there's just so many to wade through.
Yeah, I just, like, I would never, I don't want to make any sweeping statements about NFL players versus, you know, regular people, because I know there's people who work in jobs that are very physically demanding and they don't get paid as much for all the injuries that they take. You know, there's a lot of people walking around with stuff their job gave them that they didn't get paid a ton for. I don't want to make any distinctions like that between fans. I just think that, you know, you treat people. I understand the cynicism of fandom. I understand that, but there's also, I think if you lose the human element of just understanding, this is really hard for these guys. When, you know, if you've ever been on a practice field and seen somebody who's on the edge of the roster get hurt really bad, and seeing the emotion that comes from realizing that their dream might have just been taken away from them, I think it's harder to make the cynical joke. That doesn't mean I don't think that you don't write or say that Paris Campbell's availability has been an issue. It has. I mean, Chris Ballard himself said earlier this year that they can't necessarily count on him to be the two or the three because of the injuries he's had. That's a statement about roster building and factual stuff that's just true. I mean, Malik Hooker is another one who he kept getting hurt, and so the Colts didn't keep his fifth year option or re-sign him. There are those decisions that get made. It's just a question of, you know, how do you orient yourself to looking at that in terms of, you know, we probably all could use a little bit more tact in the way we speak and a little more grace in the way we speak. So I think we'll probably leave you guys with that. For the Colts Cover 2 podcast, this has been Joel A. Erickson and Nate Adkins. Only two more weeks, three more weeks? What is it? Two more weeks of
June 9th is the final day. About 3 weeks.
So three weeks left of Colts camp, of Colts offseason workouts before we get into the dog days of summer, when I will be resting too. But we'll be back next week with whatever news the Colts make here in the next week.